This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After winning the Penn Ernest Hemingway Foundation Award for short stories, my guest Mark Richard went on to write his first novel, Fish Boy, which has just been published. The New York Times Book Review called it an extraordinary first novel. In Esquire, it was described as an eloquent fever dream, a tale told headlong in the language of incantation. As you'll hear, Mark Richard has had a pretty interesting life, some of which is the basis of his surreal novel, Fish Boy. The main character, Fish Boy, is a boy abandoned in a swamp who stows away on a trawler manned by an idiot, a giant, and a pedophile. We'll start with a short reading.
In this scene, this is early in the book, where two members of the crew have been fighting for the better part of the day with axes. It's the first mate and the cook. And the main character, Fish Boy, has been sitting up in an osprey nest at the top of a drainpipe, watching the whole proceeding. And it has come to its inevitable gruesome conclusion with Lonnie having firmly planted his axe into the cook. And they're both at the after deck, and Fish Boy is still up in the nest, at which time Lonnie says, "You," said Lonnie, pointing a bloody finger at me, "get me a wrap or a towel or a blanket if you have one." Inside the fish house were some oyster sacks, and I meant to pitch one on deck as I passed, but Lonnie said to fetch it to him. "I'm so cold, Lonnie," the cook said. Lonnie told the cook that it would be all right, the cook's violent shuddering arms throwing off the comforting cover of Lonnie's shirt so that Lonnie had to hold it down. "Bring that wrap up to me," Lonnie said, and I walked a spring line aboard and I swung the rail. The oyster sack seemed small when I pressed it on the cook, fitting it like a bib napkin, as if the cook, who smelled of wet herbs and old seasonings, was preparing to eat. The cook said he was sorry to Lonnie, sorry to cook his eggs so greasy, sorry to salt the coffee, sorry to make stew from boiling his apron, sorry to blow snot into the beans, sorry that he was the cook at all, saying he had always wanted to be a blacksmith, but that he was frightened of horses, and Lonnie said that it was all right. The cook shuddered, and I pressed the oyster sack against him to keep his inside things from sliding out. The cook felt my pressure and looked down at me. "Never learned to cook," the cook said to me, and I shook my head that I never would. The cook said that he was cold straight down the middle. Could Lonnie get him a nice piece of felt blanket? And Lonnie said sure, and held the cook tighter. Lonnie did not fight the quaking arms as they rose and fell against us, Lonnie letting one arm finally reach around his neck, as I felt the other pull me deeper into the divide of the big split body. "I am so sorry," said the cook, and Lonnie said that it was all right. It was all right, and Lonnie closed us tighter inside the cook's suckering, still embrace.
Okay, Mark, let's eat.
let's have some beans.
The axe fight in this book was based on a real fight that you observed on the show?
It was something that happened. I had dropped out of college to work on these trawlers, and a lot of times you'd put in these remote fishing villages along the coast, and the worst thing you can be called is college boy, but they found out that I'd been to college a little bit. So I was kind of putting together the logs at the end of the trip. I would have to chart the courses. I would have to kind of program the Lorans and stuff like that. And at the end of the trip, this one particular trip, the captain and I were sitting at this galley table with $100,000 in cash laid out over the table, and I was figuring up the crew shares. And he had this big Navy-issue Colt 44 on the table, because when people knew you were paying out, they would come and rob you. And the first mate came stumbling into the galley with a big split lip, and he reached for the gun, and the captain said, "What do you want this gun for?" And the mate said, "Well, I'm going to shoot the cook." And the captain says, "You're not going to shoot the cook with this gun." And the mate said, "Well, give me something to kill that son of a bitch with." So the captain got up from the galley table and went over to the oven. And above the oven, there was this enormous fire axe. And he pulled this big fire axe down and handed it to the mate and said, "Here, use this." So the mate walked out through the hatch, and I'm just sitting there kind of dumbstruck with the money in my hands frozen, and the captain said, "I hated those greasy eggs, too." And in the meantime, the cook on the deck had picked up a uh, big sledgehammer that had an old piece of axe welded to it. And these guys went out, you know, went after it all afternoon fighting on the deck to the crew's amusement. You know, there was no one to stop them.
Who survived?
The mate survived. Well, they both sort of survived, but they were pretty much rough shape after that. They both were carried off.
You volunteered to be on a ship like this?
I think I did. I had spent 3 summers before working in a paper mill, which I really hated, and some friends said, you can go work on these boats and make as much in 1 week as you can make in the whole summer at the paper mill, which was completely a fallacy. You can't do that. But I bought into it as a romantic notion. So I went down to the sea and worked, finally got on the boats. By the end of summer, I'd made a little money, but not enough to go back to school. But I enjoyed doing it. And the only boats that would let me on were these kind of rough boats, where they needed college boy crews and people from jail.
College boys and people from jail?
Yeah. Well, they couldn't fit, if they didn't have the crew by the end of the, by the time we're ready to ship out, the captain would take a big wad of money down to the jail. And he had an arrangement with the sheriff where he would bail out people, and the sheriff would bring them down to the boat in handcuffs and chains and sign them over to the captain. And it was a good deal for them. They got to get out of jail. They got to work and earn a little bit of money. And when they came in, they may have earned enough of money to make their bail. So, you know, you don't know who you're working with sometimes. These guys, that they would come and unlock the handcuffs. Some of it was just, you know, house burglary. Some of it was attempted manslaughter. You never knew who your people would be that you'd be working with.
Did you read a lot when you were working on ships?
You know, it's surprising. Those guys read a lot, and they will get a bunch of paperbacks. You never know what would be on these boats. You would have romance novels and Steinbeck and all these books, and they would take the books and rip them into several parts, like a paperback. They'd tear into 4 parts, and then one person would read the beginning and then pass it around so that you would. The problem is, invariably, you'd get someone who would be reading the middle of the book, and they've been reading these 8 pages for 2 weeks, and they're the type of reader who their lips move, and you're just going, when will I ever get that section of the book? So sometimes you would have to read the book not in sequence. I remember I read East of Eden almost backwards. I read the back, and then I read something in the middle, and went back and forth, because that was the only literate book that was on this particular boat.
You went back to school, went back to college after your 3 years aboard the boats.
Right.
How did you fit in afterwards? You were probably older, and also it had this series of adventures that most of the students, I'm sure, had not had.
Yeah, it was not a good fit. I went back, and I had a beard and long hair, and actually I had this woman in tow that I'd met in Key West, and this was a college where it was coat and tie to class. So I just lived in I lived in an old farmhouse out in the country, and got very serious about my work, and did, you know, finished up and then got out hyper time.
You've had a lot of unusual jobs in your time. You've also worked as a public investigator, a bartender, a teacher. I guess there's nothing particularly unusual about any of those jobs. It's just all together. But the job I'm most interested in is hearing about your editing Military Business Review.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I have a friend who now writes for a lot of magazines who once applied to edit something called Business Forms Monthly.
Right.
We were thinking about what kinds of big controversial issues the magazine covered. What did you have to cover in Military Business Review?
Well, I actually started the magazine when I was a reporter for the...
started the magazine?
Yeah. I worked for the Navy News, and I kept finding... I was doing a story on the Naval Supply Center, which supplies the Navy with... It's the world's largest department store. You know, you can go in there and get aircraft engines and milk and whatever you need. And... After I did the story, I realized that there was no way for people would ask me, how do I sell my product to the government? And this is at the exact same time that the $500 wrenches stories were coming about. Uh-huh. And so I said, here's a good time. And then they were putting pressure on the people and the purchasers of the Navy to be more competitive. So I thought, this is perfect timing. I have people who want to sell products. I have people who need to be more competitive in their buying. So why not have some type of magazine that would bring the two together.
I don't know if our listeners appreciate that the founder of Military Business Review has written this new novel that is like wildly freakish and hallucinogenic.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain sides of my personality, I guess, that, you know, I really enjoyed doing that. I enjoyed writing this book, and I also enjoyed trying to put together this magazine for military business contractors. But I got tired of it, and I left, and here we are in New York.
Well, did it help your writing at all?
Absolutely not. It was just, again, it only helped my writing in the fact that I had money to do things that I wanted to do from the magazine and just kind of have a nice lifestyle in Virginia Beach for a while.
So what actually launched you as a writer?
I think that in my late 20s, as I was, when I was a newspaper reporter, I kept reading books that were getting all this acclaim, and I would read the books and I would think, well, I'm not so sure. And I felt that there should be books written that I would like to read, and I couldn't find them. So I thought, well, maybe I should try to write a book that I would like to read. Maybe I should write a couple of short stories that I would like to read, something sort of dark and tragic and funny. And when I was at the Navy News, I started writing these short stories and sending them to Esquire magazine. I thought that was the place to be. And they would come back and say, these are pretty good stories, but they need to be rewritten. And I'd go, look, I'm on deadline. I have ship of the week to do. I'll write you another one. How about that? So I'd write them another one. This went on for like 6 or 8 months. And finally, the fiction editor, Tom Jenks, at the time said, look, you know, you've just rewrite some of this stuff, you know. And I was going, no, I'll just rewrite. I'll write you another one. And it went on and on. And finally, we got together. He came down, was coming through Virginia. We met. And he said, if you really want to play hardball fiction, a good place to go is in New York. So, and I was tired of doing Ship of the Week and dining reviews and hanging out with the Admiral's wife at tea. So I came to New York, and I'd been seeing someone from New York. So I came up and said, here I am. So here I am.
My guest is writer Mark Richard. His new novel is called Fish Boy. We're going to take a break. This is Fresh Air. Novelist Mark Richard is my guest. He won the Penn Ernest Hemingway Foundation Award, and now he's written a new novel called Fish Boy. Listening to your voice now, I'm reminded that at the age of 13, you were a radio announcer. So I guess it's a little bit like coming home, right?
Being
on the microphone again.
I know. I love this.
How did you manage to become a radio announcer at age 13?
Well, I tell the story that I came down to breakfast one morning, and my mama had this wooden spoon, and she's standing in the doorway. She says, I've got some water boiling. Do you want some soft-boiled eggs or oatmeal? And I said, oatmeal. And, like, her eyes bugged because my voice had not changed. I mean, my voice changed overnight, literally, and it didn't crack like most boys' voices do. So she ran upstairs and got my father and brought him down. She says, tell your father what you want for breakfast. And I said, oatmeal. And he bugged out. And I guess my mom was upset because she had been raised Catholic. She maybe thought my head was getting ready to spin around or something. So the station manager of the local radio station lived across the street from us. And he told my father, he said, look, you know, your son could have a career in radio. And my father said, well, can he start today? And they took me down to the juvenile judge, who I would actually run into later under different circumstances. And they gave me one of those child release things. So in about 2 weeks, I was going pedaling my bicycle down the radio station with this voice at age 13 and doing commercials and voiceovers and stuff like that. And a couple of weeks after that, I had a radio show at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the Mark Richard Show. Pretty original title. But I did that for like 5 years, so that when I graduated at age 18, I had a resume and had done, broadcast, sports broadcasts of local high school football games and stuff like that, and had a really good time.
When you were 13, did they try to pass you off as an adult?
Well, it's such a small town, everyone kind of knew. And also, my voice having changed overnight, it was sort of like a phenomena that people would come over to the house to say, you know, they go, say something. You know, it's only a town of about 8,000, 9,000 people.
Uh-huh.
So, I really enjoyed it. I have two recurring dreams, and one of them is that, you know, I'm in a studio just playing those old 45s and pulling news off the AP machine that's chattering in the background, and it was nice. And in a weird way, I'm wondering if that's not if that's how I may have become interested in writing in some sense, because it kind of occurred to me that it's similar. You're in a room by yourself. You're speaking. You don't know if anyone's listening, and oftentimes a small station, no one is. And you're trying to set some type of narrative up with music and chatter. And I swear, sometimes when the writing is going really well, I have that sense of being alone in a radio booth and doing records and setting your own little program out. You know,
you're just creating a whole atmosphere.
Exactly.
What were your favorite records to play?
Well, at that time, I was playing. This was AM station, and FM rock had not come around, so I was playing, Clapton and the Stones and people like that. Mm-hmm. This is 69 through 74, so the rock and roll of that era. But the weird thing was is that I had they would send all the records that were out, and I would kind of hook on to these odd records like Captain Beefheart. And so I'm at this little southern radio station between the farm market report and weather, and I'm playing Captain Beefheart, you know, and people would call up and were going, what is this you're playing on the radio? And I was going, it's Captain Beefheart. I don't know anything about him either, but I kind of like it. So there was a lot of everything on the radio at that time.
It's funny. It's like you were running a little college station on your shift.
Yeah, and 13, 14 years old.
Yeah. So you said you got to see this judge at a later date for a different reason, the judge who gave you the working papers.
Oh, right, yeah.
What happened?
Well, it's a small town. There wasn't a lot to do, and he'd, get in trouble sometimes. Actually, the first time I saw him, I was in there for assaulting a police officer. A friend of mine and I had gotten some of these water pistols and were riding around, and I don't know what we were thinking, if we could get away with this, but we kind of went up and shot these policemen, and they didn't think it was real funny, so they took us down and put us in jail, and I had to go and talk to the judge, and then we had to go to court and everything, which is really wild. And the cops came in, they felt bad about it because they kind of roughed us up at the police station, and it kind of got back to the judge that they had roughed us up a little bit. And well, one of the policemen said, "Well, I know what it's like to be young. Shoot, when I was a kid, I used to throw potatoes at the mail truck." So they kind of let us off for that, and we were on probation, and the worst thing they made us do was wash a bunch of police cars or something like that. But, it's like Mayberry in a weird way.
Mm-hmm.
Just Mayberry with an edge and Captain Beefheart.
One of the things that set you apart when you were young is that you were in the hospital for some time because of your problem with your hips. What was the problem?
It was probably a congenital condition that seems to run in my mother's side of the family, of just the balls are not in the sockets correctly, and they go in and do all this breaking and putting in pins. And my father was a forester. He worked out in the woods just marking trees and stuff and didn't have a lot of money, so I ended up going to these charity hospitals. And the things they were doing then, in a charity hospital, you have to understand that you are a guinea pig for the people who are starting to practice surgery, and for better or for worse. And these are things you don't understand until you're an adult. And that is when I started to read a lot, when I was in and out of the hospitals a lot, and also saw these poor people, a lot of them from Appalachia and from the back tidewater regions, of these horribly disfigured children who were, your playmates and in the next bed next to you. And someone asked me the other day about the grotesqueries in this book, Fish Boy. And I think part of the thing is that as a child, most of my playmates in these hospitals were these horribly disfigured people, but you didn't flinch. They were your playmates, and you'd look at their face and you couldn't discern eyes or nose or mouth or something like that, but you didn't flinch when you looked at these people. And I think that's an important aspect for a writer, is to be able to have compassion for people who are like that and not flinch, though, when you look at them. You don't flinch at all. You should not.
Why were so many of the children in this hospital disfigured?
A lot of them were birth defects from, malnutrition. And different times of the year, they would have different clinics. Like for part of the summer, they have burn clinics. So children that had been horribly burned would come in. Children with brain tumors would come in, or you know, whatever the category was. And since I was in there for a long period of time in a body cast, I would see the turnover of the different types of child problems. You know, and you think you've got problems, and you see, you know, some child that's head is the size of a bushel basket, you know, being wheeled in on some sort of truck, or some kid from Appalachia comes in and his cast is opened up and it's just like infested with roaches and stuff. I mean, you just, things you can't imagine.
Did that terrify you?
I think as a child, we have some sort of survival mechanism against these things that now it's more frightening to me now when I think about them than they were when I saw them as a child. As a child, I was thinking, this is something, but I didn't know what it was. And I had playmates that they would, and I've started to write about this a little more recently, that you'd have playmates and they would be wheeled out and they'd come back and they wouldn't have their legs anymore, you know, and you just go, that's something. And you just, I don't know. It's more terrifying now than it was as a child.
It does sound like the experiences in that hospital really did have a lingering impact and you know, affect the characters in your new novel.
Right. I think I don't know how yet, though, Terry. I haven't figured it out. But I do know that I've put forth these grotesqueries, but they are complete. They're not incomplete because of their lack of some body part or lack of some part of their brain, but they are complete humans in a way. They are living in the world. They are part of the human condition. They are human condition.
Marc Richard, his new novel is called Fish Boy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.